I believe that storytelling has the power to transform our lives in the most fascinating and unexpected ways. Over my career as a journalist and social entrepreneur, I met individuals whose passion and values are making this world a better place. I am Elizabeth Filippulli, and I invite you to hear the stories of some amazing, inspirational people.
So we know each other for a few years now, and I know your story. Well, at least I think I know some part of the story. And there are so many things that created who you are today. And I would like to start, you know, by taking you a few decades back. Childhood. How was it? Just describe to us, what was it like growing up? Where? In Texas, right?
That's right. I grew up in North Texas. What used to be, I don't know if this is going to be understood internationally, but in Texas, you would call it a like kind of a rodeo town. We were known for this annual event that, if you can picture, you know, cowboys and cattle and horses and that kind of thing. And they had these kind of almost sporting events about how quickly they could rope a cow or that kind of thing. That's what we were known for. I was north of Dallas. Dallas was a big metropolitan city. And when you were driving north out of Dallas on the highway, you would hit a bunch of cow pastures eventually. And just past those pastures was my town. I mean, back then we still had a downtown that had wooden sidewalks and a place you could tie a horse off if you were to ride down there in a horse. That's all disappeared now. It's been swallowed by a shopping mall and become Northern Dallas and is unrecognizable. It's still unrecognizable. In fact, I was in Texas covering a story in election years later as a journalist. And I was on the phone with my wife driving a car, and I looked up and I saw the sign that said Louisville High School. And this is where I went to high school. And I pulled in the parking lot and I got out of the car and I was looking around and I couldn't recognize anything. And I thought this must be what was Alzheimer's feels like, because I know I'm supposed to know this place, but I couldn't place anything. My high school had been torn down and replaced with another building. The sandwich shop I worked at across the street was demolished and gone and something else. There was just nothing recognizable about the place. And the fact is that high school is in the center of the town, which means I've been driving through my hometown within minutes of the house I grew up in and didn't even know I was in that town at that moment. So there's a line in this movie, Gross Point Blank, where he goes home after years and years and his home's been sold and turned into a convenience store. And he says, I guess you can never go home again, but you can shop there. And that's true of my hometown. That is completely gone. But when I grew up there, it was a small town. We could kind of roam anywhere that you could get on a bicycle. I had friends. We played in the woods a lot. It was that kind of, I think, a quaint upbringing. But also, I realize now, very much within a bubble, very little diversity. Very little idea of what I didn't know. And, you know, before the internet, you just didn't know what you didn't know. It took me traveling down to Austin at some point in my teen years to realize, that's where the University of Texas is, that there was this whole other world out there and all these political issues and countries. And I was unaware of all of it growing up. But I left there pretty young as well. I had a sense that I wanted to go out and kind of find the world. And so the easiest way to do that, if you're from in America, if you're from a family that isn't wealthy, and mine was not, and you're from a small town, kind of the quickest exit door is the military. I joined the Marines at 17. I left for boot camp just after 18, my 18th birthday, and really never went back to that town or that life again.
Before we get to that, I would like to hear more about your family's ecosystem. Did you have siblings? And also you mentioned before that something inside you kind of urged you to look for something else, to find your knowledge.
My parents, I would describe as strict and stern, loving, but definitely stern. I have a sister who was quite a bit older than me, about 8.5 years older than me. So she was always a little bit more of a maternal figure in my life, but she also left for college when I was pretty young. I had a lot of cousins that lived near me, and they created a big part of my kind of family ecosystem. And I was extremely close to my grandparents, who were my mother's parents, My grandfather was he was an iron worker, union guy, a World War II vet. Didn't graduate high school, fought in the war. And he had these hands that could bend still. Like his fingers were like twice of mine. And I'm a pretty big guy. I'm like over 6 foot. And he towered over me. He was huge. But the thing about him was, you know, he wasn't formally educated, but he would wake up early and go outside and work. Like he built his own house with cinder block and steel. But during the middle of the day, with kind of the hot Texas sun, he'd come in and read an entire book, and then he'd go back out and work again. So every time I went in his house, he'd sit me down and say, here, read this. And it'd be some kind of article from National Geographic, or it'd be a chapter in a book or whatever. And then once I was done reading it, you know, we'd go outside and work, and that was what we were going to talk about. And so I learned from him autonomy in your education, that you're responsible for your education and the way you see the world, the way you engage your world. The value of books and reading, and it's something you do every day. You know, it was like an East Coast University elitist thing that he got his books from the library and from thrift stores. But he read every day. My grandmother did too, and she loved playing games and she loved kids. She had like 80 grandkids, and I was one of them. We were always around. So there was a lot of kind of love and nurturing from her. And then from him, I got this sense of, I want it to be autonomous. I want it to be educated. And I knew that fell on me to do it. It wasn't just a school or an institution. And that's something that has rewarded me for my whole life, I think.
Did they like the idea of you joining the military?
They hated it. My dad probably liked it. It turns out I didn't know much about my dad's side. He wasn't really close to his family. His dad left the family when he was really young. And so his mom was left to raise four kids in the late 40s, early 50s, which isn't easy being a single mom in America at that time. So he had a very poor, kind of rough childhood. He and my mom were married at 17 years old. She was a junior in high school, and he had just graduated. She went back and finished her degree, and he left and joined the Navy. The week after graduation. So he had been a military guy. He had been on a carrier and had been at the embargo down in Cuba during that whole thing. What I learned later in life is I went back and I found our family lineage on his side. And I got interested in DNA, and I wanted to see, I have this exact DNA that comes from my dad, an actual piece of DNA that he got from his dad, that he got from his dad. And so I was curious how far I could follow that single piece of DNA back through my paternal line, following father to father to father to father. And it turns out my grandfather fought in World War II, his dad, which I knew. So both my grandparents were in World War II. And then his dad had been in World War I. I found his draft card. His grandfather had been in the Civil War as part of the Confederacy. And his grandfather or great-grandfather had been in the Revolutionary War. Found this amazing document where he was requesting VA benefits, and it was handwritten, and it described the battle that he was in North Carolina, a place called Drowning Creek, where his brother was killed in that battle, and he described who his commanding officer was, and all this information. It was pretty incredible from the American Revolutionary War. And then I found his father that came to America. He came to the U.S. from England. Actually, Suffolk, England is where he left. And then I found the baptismal records, three generations going back to the 1400s in Suffolk, England, the Russians. And so it's pretty interesting. In every major war, my paternal line has been there. And, you know, I don't know if there's something genetic in that, but I can tell you my parents didn't go to college because I got married so young. And for them, it was constant what they wanted for me. I mean, there was no question that they expected me to go to university. And I was accepted to University of Texas while I was still in high school. But it was part of that, I think, wanting autonomy maybe. I didn't want my parents to pay for it, and I couldn't pay for it then. And so I thought the military has a lot of ways to pay for these things. You know, I would try that. And of the services in the U.S., there's Air Force, Navy, Army, and the Marine Corps. And by far, the Marines are considered the most difficult. And I always just thought if I joined one of the other ones, I would wonder if I could have made it as a Marine. So I joined the Marines. But when I brought the recruiter home, I was too young. At 17, you can't join the military without a signature from your parents because you're actually a child. And so I brought the recruiter to my house. This guy's name was Jamal Badani. He was a Marine, staff sergeant at the time. And told mom and dad, look, I want to enlist. Here's the recruiter. You guys have to sign the contract. Badani gave his spill about what the Marines could do for me. And my mom called him a liar and told him to get out of the house. And my dad said, why don't you boys take a walk around the block and let me talk to your mother for a minute. I'm not entirely sure what he said, but basically I think the argument was, look, we can sign this now or we can wait, and he's going to do it on his own at 18 anyway. And so we came back and we signed it, but man, she was not happy at all. And the funny story about Badani is I ran into him years later. He actually, when 9/11 happened, there was a huge backlash in the U.S. against Arab Americans. So he started an organization called Patriotic Arab Americans or something like that. And he went around the country in his uniform, you know, talking about how Arab Americans have helped the U.S. for, you know, centuries and been a part of it, our country and our history and our story. And he was even selected by Congress as like Immigrant of the Year that year. And but because of that, and because jumping forward in my story, my involvement in Al Jazeera, we end up kind of crossing paths and both living in D.C. So we've met for lunch occasionally. We're still in touch. And he still to this day says that my mom was the toughest parent he ever had to face when in his recruiting career. And he'll never forget sitting at our dining room table and they're telling him he was a liar. It turned out, I guess.
Did she prove her wrong?
Interesting. So most recruiters are liars. They make promises that they definitely can't fulfill. In my case, he said, we have this great program. It's called the Marine Enlistment Commissioning Education Program, and your son can totally get it. That he may have overstated my chances of getting it. It actually, the first year I applied, I didn't get it. You had to be a certain rank. It took me 3 years to get that rank. Then you had to take these college entrance tests, and it was very competitive, and only about 60 people in the Marine Corps get it a year. The Marine Corps, you know, it's 180,000 people in the Marine Corps. 60 of them get chosen for this program, and so I applied. I didn't get it. So had I quit then, he would have been a liar, but I applied again the next year, and I told the board, look, I'm just going to keep applying every year, so you can accept me this year or not. You'll see me again next year, and they accepted me. That second time. So I did end up going, and I went to the University of Texas, just like I always said I would, and I got my degree and I became an officer. So every promise that Jamal Badani, the recruiter, made at the table, they came true, but they came true because I kept trying. I made them come true. And anything could have derailed that at any point. I could have blown a knee. I could have not done well on a college entrance test. I could have, you know, got in such trouble that I wasn't successful enough to be picked for it, whatever. But in my case, all his promises came true.
And you're 18 and you find yourself in the Marines. How was it for, you know, a boy of that age? I'm sure that you were full of enthusiasm and, you know, passion about the things that you were about to learn, the new life, the things that you could achieve. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I would think that there are, you know, fluctuations in your emotions. Perhaps some you were revisiting whether that was the right decision or not. You would remember your mother's voice who was, you know, raising her own concerns. Or was it perhaps something entirely different to what I'm imagining? How was it?
The Marines are incredible at creating personal identity. Unlike any of the other military services in the U.S., if you ask someone in the Army, what do you do? They'll say, I'm a cook or an infantryman. If you ask a Marine, what do? They'll say, I'm a Marine. Doesn't matter what your job is, you're a Marine first. And if you really look at how they do it, there are a lot of similarities to religion in the way that they use ritual, ceremony, tradition. there are incredible similarities. And so I bought in fully. I became a Marine's Marine, and I believed. And the thing is, when you're surrounded in that bubble, it's you don't know what you don't know. And everyone kind of agrees with you, and you agree with everyone around you. You have this worldview that's a mile deep and an inch wide. You're really intensely committed to this worldview, but you don't realize how narrow it actually is. I mean, my life is very much bifurcated by my time in the Marines and before, and who I was and what I believed and what I thought I knew, and my time after the Marines. And that's when my real education began. But when I was in the Marines, I thought we were the good guys. And I thought we were always there to do the right thing. I mean, the Marine kind of motto is Semper Fidelis, which is always faithful. But they had this card. It's about the size of a driver's license. And we carried it in my wallet for two decades, really. And it says, do the right thing in the right way for the right reason. And so I really believe that that's what we were there to do. When we jump ahead in my story, looking back on that, I can see how terribly and dangerously naive that is. And I can also understand why it is that we have children fight our wars. You know, of the 180,000 people in the Marine Corps, from the generals who were in their, you know, 50s or maybe 60s, all the way down, if you took all of them and you have their average age, it comes out to like 20.4 years old or something like that. It's less than 21. So the great majority of the people that are in this service aren't even old enough to buy a beer in America. I mean, in America, we recognize you're too irresponsible. You're too young to buy a beer. But these are the people that we send to not just fight the wars, but to occupy these other lands. It's an incredible thing when you think about it, and a dangerous thing when you think about it. But when I was in it, I was a true believer.
When was your first war assignment?
So I joined in 1990. And in the 90s, it was mostly just military exercises around the world. When I got to my first base, they had already sent out who was going to go. And so I stayed back for that one. And then 90 to 95, there weren't really any wars. And I got selected for that officer program. 95 to 99, I'm at the University of Texas. I went to Quantico, and I was commissioned as an officer. So I learned to be an infantry officer at Quantico. And that was in 99 to 2000. So I was part of the very first class of Marine officers to graduate into the new millennium. And we thought the future would hold what the past held, maybe like evacuating an embassy here or an aid mission, you know, in Haiti or Somalia or something. But, you know, shortly thereafter, 9/11 happened. And within, I would say, weeks of 9/11, I was off on kind of my first real mission. At that point, I'd been in 11 years before I went off on this one. It was kind of a small mission to Eastern Africa with what they call a joint agency team. So I wasn't actually with the Marines. I was assigned out for that one. And then I came back and in 2003 was sent to Central Command to be a part of this invasion of Iraq, which at the time, I will say, fully believed in. Not only fully believed in, but I was spokesperson and voice of. I mean, I was, and now looking back on it, what a disaster. A disaster that turned out to be.
Before we get there, those 11 years between 1990 and 2001, were there some specific, people? Was there a mentor, if, you know, idea exists in the army, in the military, I don't know. But I'm sure that there must have been some figures who influenced your thinking, perhaps negatively, perhaps positively. But I would like to understand a bit, and I would like our viewers to understand who were the people or the theories or, you know, the mindsets that influenced Josh during those 11 years.
It's an interesting thing. Who I was then is not someone I'm particularly proud of now. I was kind of a violent guy. The Marines rewarded violence, so it was not uncommon to fight. And when I fought, I won. But we get arrested or something. Even on base, get arrested. And I remember this one time, I had gotten in a fight, and Monday morning I get called into the boss's office. And so you're standing there kind of locked up, your hands by your side, and you can't move. And he said, I get it. He said, when you raise young lions, sometimes you have to listen to them roar. And it was kind of a pat on the back and out the door. So I was rewarded for being the kind of guy, if you were going into a fight, that you wanted me with you. Not something I value now in my life at all, or that I'm proud of, but I was attracted to the Marines who are like that. So I can look back and see them as young, brash, strong, violent. Drinking was a big part of the culture. And those were the mentors that I went toward. I was called a break glass in time of war Marine, was kind of a saying they had. So what it meant was a real headache during peacetime back on the base. But when you're going into something, break glass and take this guy with you, break the glass around. The interesting thing is they gave me this weird job of being a, they called it combat correspondent. It was actually just a journalist for military publications. And the thing is, I was terrible at writing in high school. My strength was math. And science, but writing I was awful at. And I told them that, and I'm like, well, that's what you're going to be. And so I was just terrible at my job. So here I am, I'm getting in trouble all the time for fighting, and I'm attracted to those kind of Marines. I'm terrible at my job and getting an increasing more trouble about not being good at a job that I told them I didn't want to do. And we had a Marine come in, a kind of senior enlisted guy, and he was the weirdest dude. I had nothing in common with this guy. He wasn't athletic. He was old, and by old in our standards, oh gosh, he was probably early 30s. And, he wore these kind of thicker glasses, and he had all these kids. He'd been some kind of missionary at some point or whatever. I remember he drove this weird station wagon that he literally put a 2x4 across the seats and like had nailed a fan to it or something and plugged that into the cigarette lighter. And the fan was like the air conditioner for the kids in the back seat. It was just not a guy that instantly gained my respect, because I was this kind of young, brash guy. But he pulled me aside one day and he looked at my writing and he said, here's what I think your problem is that you're not getting enough information in your interview. So before you go to an interview, I want you to list 20 questions and show them to me before you go. And then I want you to record the whole interview, record it, and then come back and transcribe the entire interview. And then I want you to start to write a story. And so I did this, and it helped me more than any other Marine probably ever helped me. It actually helped me become a writer, which meant that I became good at my job, which meant that I could apply for that college program. That was my whole goal anyway. I owe so much to that guy that I wrote off on this kind of initial first impressions, and so little to the other Marines that I looked up to so much at that time. It's kind of an interesting thing. Sometimes we find our mentors in the least likely of places, or from the least likely people, maybe. Could also speak to what a poor judge of character I was at that age as well, and looking for the wrong qualities or being attracted to the wrong qualities.
I remember one of my mentors, he passed away 6 years ago. He was 83 when we lost him. He was perhaps the most important collector of Greek art in Greece. And he would say to me, one of the things that I remember as a piece of advice is never underestimate anyone, Elizabeth. Any person from any background, any country, any class, social, financial, educational class, can be someone who could be there to support you, give you a piece of advice which can transform your life. And this is something that stayed with me. And of course, with our job, our profession, journalism, we come across all those, different people, from state leaders and kings and queens to beggars and homeless people. Mm-hmm. And you honestly can hear the biggest piece of wisdom from someone who's a homeless person.
For me, it's been people in prison, in jails and detention facilities and homeless shelters on the other side of the border. With fault lines, I've spent most of my time with people like that. And yeah, I've learned the most important lessons of life from them.
So Iraq, and this is what year, 2001?
2003 is when we started building up. 2002, everyone started to get the orders. Early 2003, we started building up. By February 2003, I was in Doha.
What was it like? What did you feel like at the time? And so we will get to how things completely went from one extreme to another, perhaps. But as you were preparing to get there, what was your thoughts, your thinking, your state of mind? What were you expecting to find? And how or when things started to change? First of all, something clicked inside your mind at some point. Talk to us about it. That shift, when it began, how was it, the emotions within Josh, within your heart, within your mind? I'm sure that there must have been a war going on inside.
So when I went to Iraq, I believed that we were going to be these great liberators. It's terribly naive, but I believed that. And when I showed up, you know, I was in Doha. That was hundreds of miles from Iraq. All the media started coming in, and I was chosen to be a spokesperson on air. And as soon as I got to the space, I wanted to learn Arabic. I had a book with me, and I was working on it. And I thought, okay, I'll find someone who speaks Arabic and start working on it. And no one spoke Arabic on this whole base. No one. There were, it was all Western military. And then the people who were working on the base were what they called third country nationals, mostly from Nepal, Bangladesh, these places. So we set up this media center, and all the media in the world started to come. Every magazine, every TV station, or every news radio channel from countries all over the world started to come. Hundreds of reporters. And Al Jazeera was one of the organizations that showed up. And we gave them one of the best offices because we were in Doha. We were in their country. And so when Al Jazeera showed up, it was my first chance to interact with someone who actually spoke Arabic. So every day I would go by in the morning and say hi and chat with them and get them to teach me a word. And in the afternoon, I would go by again and I would use that word in a sentence. And I would start to build out this kind of conversational thing. Well, there's one point that happens where there are far more reporters than there are media guys to deal with them. And stuff was falling through the cracks. And so we said, let's assign channels to people so they have like one point of contact. When it came time to sign Al Jazeera, my boss said, hey, rushing in, see, you got a pretty good relationship with those guys. Why don't you take that one? This tells you a couple of things. Because I was the lowest ranking guy chosen to do this job. I've already told you I didn't know how to even speak Arabic. I'm not an expertise on the region. Yet we chose me to be the face of America on this channel that was so influential. At that time, it seemed as if every TV in the region had on Al Jazeera because it was the first free news channel that could report anything that was broadcast via satellite, so you couldn't stop it at the border. It wasn't cable, so people could get it all over the region. Everyone was tuning in, particularly in this moment of building up to this massive war in the Middle East. Everyone was tuning into it. So if we really were there to be these kind of great liberators and to change the Middle East, you would think that Al Jazeera would be a real point of focus of our efforts. But instead, it was the junior guy who didn't speak the language who ends up being chosen. And so I would go by. And the other thing I learned about these Al Jazeera guys early on was they got catering from off base for lunch. And it was way better than what we got at the chow hall. So I started my journey to learn this language, I would go by around lunchtime and I would eat lunch with them. And we would talk about our kids, our families, our background, our history. And I was developing a pretty good relationship with them. There was a day that there was a bombing in Basra, right when the war was beginning. And it was one of the very first explosions of this type. And so tons of attention on it. Al Jazeera was there with cameras, and they follow the victims right into the hospital. Really kind of gory, bloody, emotional footage. And I saw it in the Al Jazeera offices. And looking back on it, I can tell, and I didn't notice this at the time, but I could tell I was so much less impacted by that emotionally than my new friends were, my new associates were. And I went off and had my day. Not long after that, an army unit, a U.S. Army unit, gets ambushed, and a number of them are captured. Jessica Lynch, Iraqi TV, films this interview with these army POWs, and this was just kind of unprecedented footage. We hadn't seen anything like this since at least Vietnam, if even then. And part of that footage was a couple of dead or dying army soldiers who were on this kind of cold marble floor, and they were bleeding out. An Iraqi guy with a cigarette in his mouth kind of moving the body around for the camera. I watched that footage in our media office where just the military could go. American networks were asked not to show it, and they didn't. Al Jazeera showed it. And so as I watched it, all of my colleagues turned toward me because I had been arguing for Al Jazeera to have better access and how we should engage with them. And I was seen as kind of the Al Jazeera guy in the office at this point. And everyone turned that sick feeling that they had in their stomach kind of toward me. Like, these are the guys you're arguing for. Look what they're showing, right? It was a lonely walk back that night. And I laid in the tent looking up. I couldn't sleep. But it wasn't my colleague's reaction to me or to Al Jazeera that bothered me. What kept kind of flashing in my mind was the footage I saw in the Al Jazeera office of the Iraqis in the emergency room and all the blood. The footage I saw in the military office of the American soldiers and the blood. And why was my reaction different to one than the other? If we're here to liberate them, why didn't their blood bother me as bad as our blood? And why did I even see it as theirs and ours? And I just kept kind of going over this. And so it was this moment of something happening in me. And at that time, there happened to be some media there who ended up making a documentary later on, but they interviewed me the next day about that. And I was honest with them. And I told them pretty much the same story that I shared with you. And that goes on to be in this film that I don't know about, and I'll find out about much, much later. But this is kind of some kind of awakening happening in me. What I know now, looking back on it, is there's something that's universal in all humans, from, you know, anyone in Africa to Papua New Guinea to Australia to Western Europe to America. It's called our limits of empathy, or circles of empathy. And what it is that we are most empathetic to those that we perceive as being most like us, and increasingly less empathetic to people we see as being more different than us. So the more different you are, the less natural empathy one will feel for you. What was happening in that media office with all these military media liaisons, which I was one of, and all these other reporters, is I was the only one of those liaisons actually spending a significant amount of time with people who looked and sounded like the people in Iraq. And what was happening is internally, I was realizing we have far more in common than we had in difference. And so there was a switch flipping in me that maybe wasn't flipping in some of my military colleagues because of that, that said, hey, if you have far more in common than in difference with these people, you probably do with those people on the screen as well. And their blood should bother you as much as the blood of these soldiers over here. It ends up being a major lesson in my life that the more exposure we can have to people that we initially see as being different from us, then the more natural empathy we will have for them. Because at the end of the day, we really all do have far more in common than we have in difference. Now, years and years later, you know, I've been this journalist for 15 years. I've traveled the world. I've reported in over 60 countries. I've interviewed heads of state. People ask me, what have you learned? And I can boil down the most important thing I've learned. And I've learned it from the people in the homeless shelter and on death row in the prisons. I've learned it from mothers who I've been with at the funeral of their children. I've learned it from so many people, is that all lives have equal value. It's a really simple thing. All lives have equal value. Thomas Mann defined democracy as a society that recognizes all lives have equal value. It's a simple thing, but if you really take it in and you really buy it, it challenges almost every way that you engage in the world, from the clothes or food that you buy, to every drone strike that we don't ask questions about, to everyone who's in a refugee camp or behind bars. If they really have the same value as my life, how can I be silent about their suffering? It challenges the way you engage all of humanity, from every individual that you can reach and touch and speak to all those that you can't. It challenges the way you see everyone if you buy that one simple thing, that every life has equal value. And that lesson that I've learned in all my reporting, that's been reinforced by all my reporting, I think goes right back to that moment where something switched inside of me and said, shouldn't their suffering bother me as much as our suffering? And why do I call it their suffering and our suffering? Isn't it? What's the difference? The weird thing in my life, that's like lightning striking, it's just bizarre, is that these two young people were there filming with their cameras this thing that ends up becoming a documentary to catch me in that moment. Everyone has moments where their life changes. Everyone has epiphanies and switches that go off. Mine just happened to be captured in this moment on camera that went on to change the rest of my life.
Did you speak to anyone? Did you have anyone to consult when the click was there and you knew that you wanted something different? But that was, at the same time, it would be seen for sure as betrayal towards your comrades, perhaps towards your country, the values that you were brought up in, the Marines' values. Did you speak to anyone, or was it just yourself? Did you speak to your parents, to your father? Did you think that he would see it as, I don't know, this is not my son?
My sole confidant in that particular journey was my wife, Paige, calling her from there, writing letters to her from there, but no one else really. I had friends there in the military that I was close to, but I couldn't share these kind of things. And the truth is, I didn't understand it then to share it. I mean, I only explain it now with all the wisdom that I've gained since then. At that moment, I don't think I could have put my finger on it in any way. And had it not been captured, and had it not come out in that documentary film, I wonder how, if I would be able to trace it right back to that moment. I was forever changed, but I might not have realized, oh, it was then, you know. But looking back on it, I can clearly see that was it. You know, that was the moment. I had this other objection to what was happening there as well. The thing with being in the military is you don't get to pick your wars. The military didn't pick to invade Iraq. And as a military spokesperson, at least at that time, maybe this has been lost since then, but it's actually written into code that you're not allowed to propagandize. Military spokesperson is literally just there to keep the military open to the media, because it's the US, the public owns the military. They pay for it and they have every right to know everything that isn't classified. And so you have to have people in place to make sure that happens. But for that war, we were used in a different way. We were used in a really intentional way to sell the war. And so, for example, if you were to ask a military spokesperson, why are you going to invade Iraq before the invasion happens? The only answer they can give you is, we will invade if the president and the commander in chief orders us to, and we will not if he doesn't. You know, why he would make that order, why he would choose that, is up for him to explain. And then there's a sense of accountability, because you can vote him out of office. You know, he has the electorate to answer to. But instead, I was being given the lines to say to the media that were intentionally meant to sell the war, about WMD, about Saddam. And those lines were coming directly from the White House Office of Global Communications, which fell pretty much under Cheney at that time. And Cheney took one of his trusted guys and gave him this kind of made-up rank of a 2-star general and put him in charge of our whole operation. And he was just a Republican operative. But he would get the message of the day from that office and give it to us to go out to give to the media. And the reason they did that was the Bush administration had extremely low approval ratings at that time, and they knew that they couldn't sell this war. And so they looked at who had higher approval ratings, and it turned out Colin Powell did, the U.S. military did. Congress was really low. All the White House officials were really low. So they came up with kind of a high road strategy and a low road strategy. And the high road was to have Powell present it to the UN and make the big argument in February of 2003. And then to have people like me go on air, these young troops at war, leaving their families and kids at home, to sell it, because they knew the media couldn't challenge me on it. Unlike, you know, if someone behind a podium at the White House were trying to say it, the media could not challenge me. You know, at the time I thought I was chosen for this really prominent role because I was a good Marine, but the truth is I was cast for it. Just like you cast someone in a movie. I had a certain look, I sounded a certain way, I had a family back at home. I was picked for those reasons. And I was given the reasons to sell the war every day and then go out and do it. And I could pick on Fox News because, I mean, they're a little more than an organ of the government. But MSNBC at that time as well. When I would do an interview with MSNBC at home on the screen, what people would see, the banner would be a yellow ribbon. The yellow ribbon means something really specific in the U.S. It's during World War II, they would tie a yellow ribbon around the tree for the troops to come back home. There's songs about tie a yellow ribbon around the tree. So it's a yellow ribbon, and it would say, "Our hearts are with you." So they're saying our hearts were with me, the military guy that was being interviewed. So I could say Saddam had weapons of mass destruction or whatever, and the reporter knew he couldn't challenge me on it because his heart's with me. His editors and managers, bosses, their hearts were with me in New York. Their audience's hearts were with me. And so it was a really intentional strategy. And I came back really bothered about that. And I also came back bothered about our misunderstanding of Al Jazeera. Because at this time, when I'm going on Al Jazeera, I'm the spokesperson, Rumsfeld came out, Secretary of Defense at the time, saying, well, they're the mouthpiece of bin Laden, and they showing the beheading videos, like all these things that were completely not true. Like they'd never shown a beheading video. Bin Laden was calling for attacks against them. And it's not like I was some expert on it. It was obvious they weren't true. Al Jazeera Post, what were they called? Like the ethics at the time. And it was like, it wouldn't show that kind of video. But the truth is I never had shown that kind of video. The truth is bin Laden not only called for attacks against him, but tried to start a competitor service at one time. And so Rumsfeld was targeting Al Jazeera because he didn't like that they were showing a different point of view of the war. And that had started in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, a young general, Mattis, flew in something called Task Force 58, in these helicopters, with all the world's media on board to see it, except Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera already had a bureau in Kabul, and they were the only channel at the time, large channel at the time, that had a bureau in Kabul. So while all the American media saw the missiles ticking off and heading toward Afghanistan, which had harbored Al-Qaeda, Al Jazeera was actually able to show where they landed. And war looks really different depending on which side of the barrel you're on. And the Pentagon did not appreciate that. Before Afghanistan, you know, Al Jazeera Arabic started in 1996. 1998, the White House said they were a beacon of light in the Middle East. They were very supportive of the idea, this idea of free press in the Middle East, until they started showing where our bombs were landing. And the U.S. promptly bombed that bureau in Kabul and destroyed it. And so when the same thing started happening with the invasion of Iraq, that you had this different point of view coming on Al Jazeera, Rumsfeld started challenging it, but he did so in a way that was not truthful. And I saw that as being extremely dangerous because so many people in the region were watching Al Jazeera. And it was so easy to know, if you knew anything about Al Jazeera, it was so easy to know what Rumsfeld was saying was not true. And so as soon as he did that, and everyone knew he was lying, well, if he's lying about that, what else is he lying about? It killed the credibility. It killed the credibility of the United States with the Al Jazeera audience. It's one of many things it did, but it was definitely one of the things. And so I came back kind of frustrated with that. To me, it felt like if the war had anything to do about trying to change the Middle East, then the battle of ideas that was happening on Al Jazeera Arabic at the time might be more important than any battle that was happening on the ground in Iraq at the time. It might have a far greater impact. And here the U.S. was just making a strategic, foolish error based on misinformation. But when I came back from the war with these frustrations about having sold this thing, growing doubts about the cause and meaning of the war with WMD, and then just watching my government lie about something that I witnessed, I was really disappointed. I was really disheartened. But I didn't have much, I didn't have any kind of platform. I was just a junior officer at the time. And I found myself in this bizarre world. I was representing the Marines in Hollywood. So I was sitting on the sets of TV shows, playing fake war, having just come from what felt like fake war at this media center. It was a really surreal time in my life. And I got back around mid-summer of 2003, first Monday of 2004, February, first Monday in February 2004, I get a phone call at my office that said, "Hey, Captain Rushing, you don't know me, but I just saw your movie at Sundance and wanted to say thank you." And I had no idea what they were talking about. And I thought, well, I'm in this office representing us in Hollywood. Maybe there's some movie we sponsored or something. And they just put my name in the credits. So I Googled my name in Sundance and up comes this movie, Control Room. And I'm like, yeah, that's not me. I've never heard of it. And then I see all these stories like New York Times, LA Times, Wall Street Journal, Marine sympathetic to Al Jazeera in this film. And I thought, oh no, that could be me. And I got a call from the Pentagon same day that said, what the hell, Rushing? Why are you in a movie about Al Jazeera? And I told them, I don't know. And they said, we are getting requests from all the media to talk to you, and we're saying no comment. And I said, well, let me figure out what this movie is. I really don't know. And so I called the company that bought the movie, which is Magnolia Films in New York. This awkward kind of like, "Hi, my name's Josh. I think I might be in a film that, you know, you guys bought." And they're like, "Oh my gosh, you're Captain Rushing." And so it turned out, if you go back to when I was at Central Command in Doha, there was a point where a professor from the American University at Cairo wanted to interview me about Al Jazeera for this kind of academic journal that he was keeping. His name's Abdullah Schleifer. He's a legend in Middle East media and a really great guy that I love. Normally, we would say no to that kind of request, but he had been the former bureau chief of NBC. My boss was actually married to an NBC reporter, so he felt like Abdullah was kind of in the family in some way, and said, okay, you know, let him talk to Rushing. And he goes, can I bring along a student who's doing a grad project about Al Jazeera to film it? And I said, yeah, sure. So the student comes along with his girlfriend at the time, and they filmed this interview with Abdullah, and they say, can we stick around a few more days and get some B-roll of Al Jazeera? And I said, sure. And they filmed me a little in that time. And then they came back and said, hey, we're following this reporter, Hassan Ibrahim, with Al Jazeera. And we think he's interesting, you're interesting. Well, you guys have a conversation. We just want to see kind of melding of the minds. So he came out, first time I met him, we had this conversation, they record it. And the conversation was like a lot of these go that are off the record. The first third is why we're there. I'm giving the government line. The second third is his anger about it. The third third is me trying to find some kind of common ground. He leaves. I don't think much about this. I don't think much about them because during this time I give 1,000 interviews to, you know, reporters all over the world. So it didn't occur to me that that's what this film would have been, was from those students. But it turns out that the girlfriend had actually made a documentary before, a really good one called Startup.com. She, Harvard trained documentarian, and this became her second documentary film. And it was Control Room. And it was about Al Jazeera's coverage of the world, this war, this different perspective they had. And I was one of the characters in the film, but in my character, they showed this kind of arc of change. They used the first third of that conversation in me giving the government line in act one. Act two is me getting it back from Hassan, who's anger. Act three is me finding common ground, which comes out as if I've had this arc of change over time, because also in the documentary is cut in the war happening over several months. And so you'd think this debate with Hassan and I, it comes out as if that happened over that same time, but it really didn't. I just met him this one time. Although I will say, using their artistic license, they got closer to the truth than they would have had it come out as just that one conversation. I really did have that epiphany over time, and that conversation really did encapsulate it. I haven't watched that film many times in my life. It's hard for me to watch, but I did happen to see it in the last year or two. And it's amazing because now I look back and I see me as so naive, and I see everything Hassan's saying is going right past me. I'm not really hearing it. I'm not really engaging with it. It's like I'm just listening for a chance to respond or a segue to get to my point, but I'm not really understanding his point at any time. And I don't think you realize that. I don't think most people realize that watching it, but I can see it in me. And it's disappointing to think that that's what I was then. And it makes me wonder how often I'm like that now as well. And I know this is a long story, but eventually what ends up happening is the movie gets released in theaters across America to tons of press. And that's one kind of set of stories. Then there's a second set of stories when everyone wants to interview me and the Marine Corps says, no comment. Lands on the front page of LA Times, says Marine lands in film and collides with superiors. All of a sudden, I have a platform. And as I mentioned before, when I came back from the war, I had something to say. I had something to say about how the war was being sold. And I had something to say about Al Jazeera. Now, at this point, I've been in the Marines 14 years. I'm guaranteed, I'm commissioned for life. There are two different types of commissions. Some are the kind that go for like 4 years. And then there's a small group of people that are commissioned for life. So I'm guaranteed retirement at 20 years. All I have to do is stay in another 6 years. And for the rest of my life, I'll have some portion of my pay. I'll have health care for me and my family. I'll have all these incredible benefits. But if you get out at 14 years, you leave with nothing. There's no 401k, there's no retirement, there's no medical, nothing. The day you leave, it's you sever ties. And so I had conversations with my wife, Paige, and I felt like it, if civic responsibility has anything to do with why I actually joined the Marine Corps, then I feel like I can do much more civic good out where I can actually talk about these things honestly than staying in and being quiet. But it will benefit us more if I stay in and keep my mouth shut. And that just didn't sit right with us. And so we decided to get out. And I was so unprepared. I resigned out of the Marine Corps. I had no health insurance. I did not have a resume. I got a call from Ted Koppel and Nightline that they wanted to have me on the show. I hung up, I looked at my closet, and it was a realization that I couldn't wear my uniform on the show. And I didn't own a civilian suit. That was one of the first realizations of how ill-prepared I actually was for this. But it's what I did. I think it was the right thing for the right reason. It was months later that I got the call to help start Al Jazeera English. It was in December of 2004. But between the time I got out and December, I was traveling the country speaking about the war. I don't think any soldiers, prominent soldiers, had come out against it at that point. So there was a lot of press around me. I was doing a lot of media, particularly on Fox News of all places, because I felt like they needed to hear it the most. It was kind of a terrifying situation to be in, but I would keep repeating the mantra to myself. It's better to be honest than clever. So anytime I would go on a show like Bill O'Reilly or Hannity, I would just tell myself, I know what I saw, and it's better to be honest and clever. I don't have to win any debate here. I just have to tell the truth. And I just did that over and over again.
And at the time, you received a lot of death threats, didn't you? So it was not an easy time. It was not a transition to stardom through becoming, you know, an Al Jazeera face.
The death threats came after I helped start Al Jazeera English. In the very beginning with Al Jazeera English, I was called the new face at Al Jazeera. I was on the cover of magazines in the U.S. I wore a keffiyeh. It was, you know, it was everywhere. It was across all the media. And Fox News, again, I felt like they needed to hear it the most. This is who I was going to go on. When I would go on, they would promote me coming on by showing me in uniform with a word traitor and question mark underneath my name. And if you Google my name to this day, one of the first Google images that pops up is that. But if you keep scrolling down those images, you'll see an image where I'm on the Today Show, which is one of the biggest, it is the biggest morning show in America. And they strap me as Josh Rushing, anti-American, question mark. And so, yeah, the death threats were coming in. It was still at a time where you had this kind of post 9/11, the war in Iraq was still young. You couldn't question what America was doing without being, you know, called a traitor. So the death threats were online where they were saying I should be taken out before I give away all the secrets, you know, any classified information I might have had. I had federal agents following me all over the place. And so when I would do interviews, they would tell people that there were national security consequences if they spoke to me. If I went near the border, like I was in North Dakota near the Canadian border, Fox News ran a ticker that Al Jazeera was probing the northern border. Yeah, I was basically being painted in the U.S. as a threat to the country. And we had bodyguards for my family that they came and checked out our security situation, stayed with outside of the apartment for a few days while I traveled so the page would be safe. But goes back to, you know, that Marine thing where I said they're really big on identity. That was hard because when I got out, the only identity I had was as a Marine. And it was deep. And then all of a sudden, not only was I not a Marine, but I was a traitor. That was pretty difficult. But it was also the Marines that taught me do the right thing in the right way for the right reason. And I knew what I was doing was right. I knew what Rumsfeld was saying was a lie and it could be proven. And so all I had to do was speak the truth and I would be right. I knew that I shouldn't have been used to sell the war like that. And it could be proven. It's written in U.S. code. And so all I had to do was speak the truth. You know, when I mentor young people now, I tell them, when I say do the right thing in the right way for the right reason, often in life, the hardest part of that will be knowing what the right thing is. Because the more intelligent and capable you are, the more you're able to rationalize things. And it's not always black and white, what's the right thing? It just isn't. It takes a bit of wisdom. But I was really fortunate in this situation. I knew what the right thing was. And so from there, it became a really simple moral calculus. If you know what the right thing is, that's the hard part. Do the right thing. You know, when they tell Marines that, they're talking about it, they don't say with a caveat of unless it's scary or unless it's going to get you killed or unless you're sending someone else to their death or unless you're going to be called a traitor or criticized. They don't say those things. It's do the right thing in the right way for the right reason. And I knew that I was. And so it took me a while to shake that identity of being a Marine to being, you know, something else. It was also from that identity that I got that mantra that helped me out so much to get through that time.
We talk about civic responsibility. We talk about accountability. And I wonder if the idea of accountability is a value that is set in stone or if it's like a piece of cloth that people would, you know, change it according to their own measures, according to their own ideas or interests. What is accountability after all? What is civic responsibility after all?
I think that works on multiple levels. As we become more evolved people, accountability can mean different things. I think the most important accountability is accountability to oneself, to your own integrity, to your own autonomy. Are you living an intentional life? Are you making your choices in life? And are you accountable for those choices? When you fail, are you accountable to yourself? Do you hold yourself accountable? For me, that's the kind of accountability that I aim toward. Beyond that, we have an accountability to others. This is very, very important. This cuts to the meaning of life. It's across cultures and countries. I don't think you can truly be accountable to others if you're not accountable to yourself. That's why I list that one first. But then accountability to others. What do we owe others? And it starts in rings around you from your immediate family. How am I accountable to my spouse, to my children, to your greater family, to your friends, to your occupation, to your neighbors, to your community, and then to people of the world? How am I accountable for every drone strike that happens and no one asks questions about? My accountability doesn't end here at my front lawn. It goes to wherever that drone strike happened because it happened in my name. So accountability is something that I think a lot about. And in my reporting on fault lines, almost every episode we chase accountability. Fault lines has a pretty simple premise. It's this half-hour documentary investigative style show about America that's been on Al Jazeera for over 10 years now. It's done pretty well. You know, we're nominated for 6 Emmys this year. We've won multiple Emmys for investigative reporting, which is kind of huge when you consider we're Al Jazeera and we're in America and who we're competing against. But it's a simple formula. The formula is that almost every episode is about a systemic injustice. Systemic injustice. And we find people's lives who represent that injustice and the suffering they're going through because of that injustice. And we go into their life deeply and we try to understand their suffering. And then we come out of their life and we trace that suffering to this systemic issue. And then we say, who's responsible for that systemic issue? And then we chase accountability to that person. And so, you know, so often people won't sit down and give me an interview because they know this isn't going to work out in their favor. So I chase them down. In America, the press has a kind of deference for people in power that they don't do this. But I literally have chased U.S. senators from their cars in the parking lot to their office where they tried to slam the door on me. And I put my boot in the door and wouldn't let them so that I could ask them these questions. I've chased governors out of greeting lines. I've chased Ted Cruz into the men's restroom in Congress because he thought that he could get away from me there. And I waited outside the restroom door until he came back out. Because accountability is that important. And because in each one of those situations, it's not accountability to me. It's accountability to those people that we met in the beginning who are suffering that injustice. And they will never get to ask that person why. I'm their advocate in doing that and have a responsibility to them in doing that in the way that I do it. So accountability, it's a fascinating concept. I don't think I gave much thought to it as a young man. I think if you would have asked me about accountability when I was a young man, I would have told you something to do with getting in trouble when I do something wrong. And I would have seen it as this kind of outside force from some authority over me, some authority that I probably didn't appreciate. And it was my job to evade that, my goal to evade that kind of accountability, right? To do what I want. Now I think so much more about it, particularly that element about it being accountable to myself. And then it flows out from there to all these other people I'm accountable for. And it becomes a guiding principle in life.
You're someone who, from a very young age, didn't really like the meaning of comfort zone. From the age of 17, even before that, you were trying and you were breaking your own boundaries, your own limits. And that was bringing you into a new world, which was not easy, would not be comfortable, would be a new world that you would have to survive in. I think that most people do not like that. And that's perhaps the reason why our world is not as accountable as it should be. It's so unfair. We've covered the world, both you and me, different parts of the world. But the bottom line is that people are experiencing injustice and poverty and do not have access to opportunities as they should be having. Is it because there is not enough of us stepping outside our comfort zones? And what would you say to the younger generations, the younger people?
You know, comfort zone, and whether I'm in a comfort zone or not, is just something that doesn't occur to me. It's just not something I ever consider. There are a couple of things I've only realized later in life, looking back, that I'm a little different in some way, and I'm not sure why. And my wife, and I would have thought it was normal, but my wife constantly tells me, no, other people are not like that. One of them is I tend to not care what other people think about me. That just doesn't register. I just don't think about it. And I think from what I understand, other people that's kind of a constant monitor in their head is hearing what other people might think about them or how or judge them or whatnot. That doesn't, I don't know, maybe it's narcissism or something. I only hear my own judgments. I don't really think about, it just doesn't occur to me to think that way. And comfort zone is something I've never thought about either. And I've never been the kind either that's always like, oh, I need a challenge or whatever. It's not so much that. Comfort zone isn't something that I've ever thought about or desired or wanted. Or it's not like when I thought back about my life that I want to go out and find my comfort zone in the world. I mean, as naive as I was, I wanted to find adventure and, you know, understanding. And I admired great explorers in the past. You know, I read this biography when I was young. I was probably 15 or 16 or something, of Sir Richard Francis Burton. He's a British explorer who was credited with finding the source of the Nile. He's credited with, translate the Kama Sutra, credited being the first Westerner to go into Mecca, Medina, and write about it during Hajj. He was in the military in India. And it just seemed to me like, man, that guy was out there living something that I wasn't seeing in my small town. And so I kind of wanted to go find that type of thing. But yeah, comfort zone wasn't ever anything that that occurred to me. And the latter part of your question about injustice and suffering, it's the hardest part about this job for me emotionally, has been how do you reconcile such different experiences in life? How do I leave the refugee camp with its dirt still on my boots and get on the plane with a glass of champagne? You know, how do I live here in my leafy suburb of Washington, D.C. with my family? And in my fridge, there are berries that are rotting that were picked by a family in Mexico that work 30 days a month to pick those berries and can't afford electricity in their home. How do I leave the field where they're picking those berries and come home and toss out the berries that are rotting in my fridge with no consequence in my life? I don't fully know how to reconcile that. I've never quite figured it out, but I know that it doesn't sit right. Something's not right.
How many kids do you have, Josh?
I have 5 children. From the age of 19 on, I still remember the moment. He wasn't even born yet. I remember the exact moment. I was driving down a gravel road to this, we call them mobile homes in America, these crappy, really cheap homes. And that's what I could afford at the time for us to live in, this, his mom and me. And she was pregnant. And it was out in the middle of a cornfield where this guy had a piece of dead ground he couldn't grow corn in. So he put a mobile home there. And so I'm driving down and it's dark. And I remember the moment of realizing this baby's going to depend on me. And at that time, I was still getting in a lot of trouble. And it was around that same time that mentor came into my life and taught me how to write. I really needed that at that moment because I realized I needed to change something. I was not going to get that college program. I was not going to be a success. And this guy, this baby, was going to depend on me. And that was definitely one of those like switches flipping in me where it's like, okay, I've got something else. But I can look back like, there's a whole part of adolescence I didn't go through. And so in some ways it was arrested development. I think I ended up kind of going through that in later times in life that weren't really beneficial to me. But there was also a sense of maturity and responsibility that I had to take on very, very early. Identity is interesting. I think about identity a lot. I don't think I could live an intentional life holding myself accountable if I wasn't really clear on my identity. And I wasn't for a long time. I was just like me floating through this universe. But now I'm really clear about it. I am number one me, this autonomous individual that I'm accountable to and responsible for. And then I'm a husband that has his own set of accountability. And then I'm a father. And then I'm a journalist. And then I'm a friend. Well, then I would say I'm a son and brother, and then I'm a friend. And so keeping that in mind all the time, it helps guide kind of all the actions in my life. But that thing, that father piece, I was a kid when I became a father. So I've been a father my whole adult life. And that definitely shapes like who I am. I recently had a bit of a life scare. And you have those kind of moments where things flash before your eyes and you don't know if, you know, from this moment, if you will continue on, or if you do, you'll continue on in a completely different way. And I'm being rushed through this kind of emergency room and I see like the hospital lights going by. And the one thing I was thinking of was do I have enough life insurance? Do my retirement account space have access to it? What do we owe on the house? It's like all these things. And what it tells me is in that moment boiled down to my essence that I'm a nurturer, a protector, and a provider. And so these things shape me. And that immediately goes back to me having been a dad. I can easily say that since I was 19 in that drive down that gravel road that night. That's where that started. In that moment, that started. I have 5 kids now. So one is older than the others. He's a lawyer in New York. I'm really proud of him. He's doing really great. And then I have 4 other ones that are like 14, 12, 10, and 5. There are a few things that I get more out of in my life than being a dad, though.
Do your children realize that their father has written history?
No. I mean, I don't think of myself that way. Guarantee you, Paige wouldn't let me get away of thinking myself in that way. No, they know that I'm on TV, but they don't realize that that's odd. You know, like to them, that's just kind of natural the way that it is. I've actually filmed them on Fault Lines. They've been on my show. And so they realize that, but I don't think they realize that there's anything particularly unusual about my job.
I mean, the way I think, I mean, this interview is fascinating. I mean, it's given me goosebumps. So the things you've said, everything you've shared, and I cannot thank you enough for this honor. But don't you think that they should know your story and who you are and the things you did and the values that you stood by? They should know it more or deeper. Of course, I mean, they're young, but I don't know.
My older son's aware, right? He was, let me see, when did Control Room, 2004? He was 12 when Control Room came out. When I started Al Jazeera here in America, you know, he was this goofy little kid with braces and everyone knew him because he was around the office all the time. And now he's this lawyer in New York. They'll know in time. There was a time where everyone knew me as a Marine. Even years after I was out of the Marines, people knew, well, he was a Marine. My kids only recently, this younger batch of kids, only recently found out I was in the Marines. And they found out because they were in my basement digging around and they found a sword, an actual sword made of German steel that was part of my uniform. I haven't kept much. I got rid of everything. But I kept the sword for some reason. I don't know why. It's in a box down there. And so my kids come running up the stairs. Dad, we found a sword. You know, where did this come from? I'm like, a different life, you know? Yeah, they'll know in time, but it's not the thing I need them to know. You know, the other night I've taught all my kids to ride bikes and my wife and I have taught them, not just me. But my daughter was riding in a parking lot. We were letting her go around and kind of get used to it. And she is 10. And she had a really bad spill. And her body was twisted, her arm was twisted. I was worried. And I just went running for her and she cried and said, I'm okay. And she got back up on the bike and she rode some more. And then we were driving, I put the bike in the car and we were driving home. And she said, you know, Dad, you want to know what I was thinking about when I was laying there, when I knew I was going to be okay. And I said, no, I mean, like, why? She go, I heard your feet running. That's all they need to know. The other stuff they'll learn about.
I guess, I mean, I have so many things that I wanted to, and I would like to ask you, but I don't want to, you know, impose. But how do you think America has changed over the last two decades? What was the America you knew back then and the America today?
I can say that I love America. I can love the culture. I want the people here to do well and to thrive with no sense of nationalistic hate of any other culture or any other people. You know, there's a difference between nationalism and patriotism, and they're easily confused. Nationalism is the belief that the world should be broken up into nations, that this is the organizing force that the world should have, and that one's devotion, the emotional attachment to one's nation, includes a kind of hate toward other nations and toward minorities within your own nation that don't belong to the majority religion, ethnicity, or sect. Nationalism has taken hold in the U.S. in a really terrible way. You know, Trump said it in 2016 at a rally in Houston to a cheering throng of thousands. You're not supposed to use this word nationalist. Well, I'm a nationalist. We should be nationalistic again. Nationalism is what led to Nazis in Germany. Nationalism is different than patriotism. Patriotism is a love for one's home without that hate part. And to confuse the two is to confuse fear and courage. There's a lot of good happening in the U.S., though, bubbling up from above. We give so much attention to the very top of the tree. But real change is happening at city councils across America. Real change is happening at state levels across America. Things like mass incarceration is being reconsidered. Decriminalizing nature, decriminalizing marijuana, so we're not locking up mostly African Americans for a drug that's used mostly by white people. These kind of changes are happening at a more rapid rate than maybe any time in my life. There is a progressive sweep across America, but we don't see it as much. But there's also this kind of pessimistic view we have that things are worse and getting worse. And it's easy to have that as a journalist for sure, because all we do is cover negative things. But if you step back and you actually look at the world and the significant ways that you measure it, there's been amazing progress in the last century. Poverty has been cut down by far. People's access to clean water has been cut down by far. People's access to education has risen greatly. People's hunger has been cut down by far. Death by violence has been cut down by far. And all of these are measurable things. You can take them 100 years ago and you can take them now, and you can see massive gains, really greater gains than at any point in history. There's a terrific book by a Swedish epidemiologist called Factfulness that makes this argument that we as humans, because of our fearful protective nature, are inclined to be drawn toward negative bias of the way we see the world. It's a way that if we see the threats, maybe we can do something about them. So it's kind of built into us. And then the way our media works is we constantly highlight the negative in the world. So it feeds into that negative bias for sure. But if we really sit down with the numbers and we say, how many people are making more than $2 a day 100 years ago and now, and adjusting, you know, for inflation, the number is like 10 times greater now. How many people were dying of hunger 100 years ago? How many people died of violence last century and now? And things actually are progressing. I think we need to maybe do a better job of telling that story as journalists. Look at this progress. What can we attribute that progress to? Now let's fortify those systems. Let's protect those systems. Let's fund those systems, because everybody benefits from them. Suffering anywhere in the world is suffering, even on a very selfish level. Suffering anywhere in the world can lead to suffering everywhere. Instability anywhere in the world can lead to instability everywhere or anywhere. And so let's take a real look using real data, what's working. And then let's commit to those things. But that takes a bit of education. It takes a bit of sorting to know what real data is and how to find it. And it takes, you know, humans won't do anything if they're not compelled by story. The way we understand ourselves is by story. What I've told you today is a story. It's not facts, it's story. And so we need storytellers to tell that story. We need them to tell it really well so that we don't throw out the things that are working.
Do you think we could do with more kindness, but not kindness as in niceness, not kindness as in courtesy or good manners, kindness as in candor, as in courage, as in building resilience, as in tough love, especially in times of crisis and uncertainty and suffering and confusion, as you mentioned? What if the answer is that we need to become more caring for others? So kindness as caring.
Kindness could certainly work. One of the problems is, and I quoted Thomas Mann, an unusual amount today, but Thomas Mann wrote about this in The Coming Victory of Democracy in 1938, that why fascists love terrorism. And he used the word terrorism in 1938. It sounds so relevant today. Terror brings out the worst in humans. Fear brings out the worst in humans. So it's deeply powerful. And it's all too tempting for leaders who desire power above all things to use fear, that confusion that you talked about. So the leadership comes from people using that fear, and they'll turn that fear against the fear of others in order to create their own power. So we need a generation of leaders who are above that. We need a generation of leaders who choose the light over the dark. A generation of leaders who say that kindness and accountability, responsibility, these are the way out. A generation of leaders that sees a world full of possible allies rather than adversaries. I have hope in this next generation that they'll be that. They're going to rise to be those kind of leaders that we need.
Is there anything else that you would like us to add?
You know, that identity thing we talked about. Mine's no longer, I'm a Marine, I'm a journalist. And that story thing we talked about, story is so important. All religion is story. Everything, how we see ourselves is story. How we understand the world is story. So being a storyteller has a power that I didn't realize when I first got into this. It found me. Journalism found me. Paul Gibbs, someone who changed my life by calling me after he saw Control Room in London, found me. But now I get it, man. I'm an evangelist for journalism now. The power of storytelling is so strong. And I think sometimes we just tell the story. It's right in front of us so often because we have to. The loudest story of the day, we've got to tell it, right? The truth is, I think we could give a little more thought about the stories that need to be told. And maybe I'm going to spend this next part of my life trying to tell those stories, the stories that we need to hear rather than just stories in front of me, a kind of intentionality to the stories that need to be told. That's something that I would like to give more thought to. I want to have these conversations with people that I'm interested in around the world. And I want to highlight voices, I think, that people need to hear around the world. And so at this moment, that's what I'm working toward in my life. So 10 years from now, I would love to have a decade worth of those kind of interviews, a decade worth, a body of work of these kind of meaningful interviews, talking about what this is really all about. And by this, I mean life.